NPR. For Radio Catskill, this is Rosie Starr. Welcome to Farm and Country, locally produced radio about rural life in the Catskills and the Delaware River Valley. On today's show, Sullivan County resident Sally Rowe nurtures an impressive garden located in Barryville, New York. With her dedication and style, Sally is a participant in this year's Garden Conservancy Summer Tour that takes place Saturday, June 28th. I visited her garden last year, and I want to share this inspiring perennial farm and country archive with you. All of that and Keith Hubbard's Star Talk report coming up on today's Farm and Country. After news headlines from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Giles Snyder. Attorney General Pam Bondi says Kelmer Abrego Garcia has been returned to the United States to face criminal charges.
On May 21st, a grand jury in the Middle District of Tennessee returned a sealed indictment charging Abrego Garcia with alien smuggling and conspiracy to commit alien smuggling in violation of Title 8 U.S.C. 1324.
Abrego Garcia's case is a flashpoint in President Trump's immigration crackdown. He's the man who was mistakenly deported to El Salvador. He has now been returned to the U.S. after the court said his due process rights were violated. Aisha Brayboy is the state's attorney for the Maryland County where Abrego Garcia lives. She spoke to the BBC.
I think that this case should play out, and should he be found guilty, he should face whatever consequences there may be. But because the U.S. government and the Justice Department in particular was so defiant in saying that it was not going to comply with the Supreme Court orders, this indictment is coming at a very interesting time.
Abrego Garcia is due to be arraigned next week after appearing in federal court in Nashville last night. Meanwhile, a veteran lawyer in the U.S. Attorney's Office in Nashville has so far declined to comment on his reported resignation in protest to the indictment. Los Angeles Mayor Karen Bass accusing federal immigration authorities of targeting workers and not the employers who profit from them.
What about the people who run this company? So it would seem to me that if there were undocumented workers here, what about them? What is the penalty for them?
Bass speaking after ICE agents took several people into custody in L.A.'s Fashion District and elsewhere in the city. ICE says more than 40 people were detained. The arrest brought protesters to the streets, and there were clashes last night. Police used tear gas and flashbangs after some demonstrators hurled chunks of broken concrete. Over the past week, there have been similar confrontations in San Diego, Chicago, and Minneapolis, leading to warnings by federal officials against interfering with immigration enforcement, as NPR's Martin Costi reports.
Some protesters say they object to the deportation of people without criminal records. Others say they don't like the way ICE agents have gone about their work wearing masks and tactical gear. In Minneapolis, Ryan Perez is with a group called COPAL, which trains volunteers to monitor ICE operations.
The most important thing is that nobody is here to obstruct in the moment and enforcement. We need to collect the evidence, ask the questions, take the photos, and then move to our trusted legal partners to determine in court, if necessary, if violations have occurred.
Homeland Security officials say agents wear masks because some have received death threats, and a DHS official warned that anyone impeding ICE's work could face prosecution. Martin Costi, NPR News.
And you're listening to NPR News.
I'm Thane Peterson. Join me for great music from the newest artists with a little bit of classic jazz from the greats of the past thrown into the mix. Living Jazz, Saturday at noon, only on Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Farm Arts Collective, located on Willow Wisp Organic Farm in Damascus, Pennsylvania. Farm Arts Collective's programs intersect the practices of farming, performance, food, and ecology. FarmArtsCollective.org. From the Community Foundation of Orange and Sullivan, a publicly supported philanthropic institution, CFOSNY.org, and from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Welcome back to Farm and Country. I'm your host, Rosie Starr. On today's show, Sullivan County resident Sally Rowe nurtures an impressive garden located in Barryville, New York. With her dedication and style, Sally is a participant in this year's Garden Conservancy Summer Tour that takes place Saturday, June 28th. I paid a visit to her home and garden last year and want to share this inspiring perennial farming country archive with you. But first, here is Keith Hubbard with this week's Star Talk Report. Thank you for joining us on Radio Catskill for this week's locally produced Farm and Country.
For Farm and Country, I'm Keith Hubbard, and this is Star Talk. Cape Canaveral was chosen as the launch site for the U.S. space program for two reasons. It sits relatively near the equator compared to other locations in the U.S., and it is on the East Coast. Rockets launched into space get a boost in speed due to Earth's rate of spin, and that boost increases as you near the equator. The diameter of Earth changes based on your latitude. The diameter is shortest at the poles and largest at the equator. At the equator, the diameter of Earth is 27 miles greater than at the poles. The distance from the center of the Earth affects how fast objects move. The farther away from the center, the faster the object moves. Earth's rate of spin is 1,040 miles per hour at the equator, but drops to 914 miles per hour at Cape Canaveral. This means that rockets launched from Cape Canaveral get a 914 miles per hour boost on their way to reaching the 17,000 miles per hour needed to escape Earth's gravity. Earth spins west to east, and rockets follow the direction of Earth's spin. This makes the east coast of the U.S. a more desirable location to launch from. Any rocket launched on the east coast and traveling eastward will quickly be over the Atlantic Ocean. This makes the east coast a safer place to launch from than the west coast. The fact that rockets launched from Cape Canaveral get a large boost from Earth's rate of spin, and they travel over water on their way to space, is why the location was chosen.
For Farm and Country and Star Talk, this has been Keith Hubbard, reminding you to keep looking up.
Sullivan County resident Sally Rowe has been gardening for a bit more than 30 years. While she considers herself a novice, her creativity and dedication has earned her a date with the Garden Conservancy Summer Tour, scheduled for Saturday, June 28th. I have driven over to Barryville, New York at Sally's invitation to visit her garden that occupies 1/5 acre. After sipping herb-scented ice black tea, we began a stroll on her curved stone paths set in lush, pruned green grass to share a present moment. Sally, first introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about yourself, your life, and what led you to this garden tour conservancy experience.
My name is Sally Rowe, and I came from a background that had nothing to do with gardening. I was shocked that I ever became a gardener. It just wasn't something that was introduced to me. I had no mentors. I had no experiences. And when we bought our farmhouse, I put a plant in the ground, and that was it. I just got completely turned on. And ever since then, I've had my hands in the dirt. And so that was in 1992. But it was an evolving thing. I started out slowly. I started out with annuals, and I migrated to perennials, and we were weekenders, and then we became full-timers, and so on and so forth. So as time went on, my commitment, my dedication, my seriousness in terms of this as a pursuit, a passion, it just grew and grew like the garden. And so that's how I came to gardening, not knowing anything, and I'm completely self-taught. And so it's been quite a wild ride.
Well, describe your property in terms of acreage and type of environment that we have here in Barrieville.
Sure. Well, we're on a hill. We live on Hillside Road, and it's an old farm property. So we have meadow, we have woods, we have a stream, all in the back of our property. But the front of our house, the front of our property, which parallels the road, is the part of the property that I decided to garden because I thought, oh, I want pretty plants in front of the house. And it just, that's just how it happened. So we have, it started out as one main garden in the front of the house, and we had a vegetable garden. And then in more recent years, I created a second ornamental garden. My husband, Anthony, he's in charge of the vegetables. I do all the ornamentals. I now have two gardens that are separated by a driveway, and it's very open. It's very sunny. It faces pretty much southwest, and so it's a hot garden, and which is good for a lot of plants and not so good for other plants. So that's how you decide what to plant, right?
Well, when we were walking around before and you're showing me the diversity of your plants and gardens, you use an expression, every plant has a story, and we stopped in front of these remarkable peonies. Tell us the story that you want about these peonies.
Well, we were having dinner at the Fat Lady Cafe, the wonderful Fat Lady Cafe that is no longer in existence, but she had these peonies in a vase, and I was ogling them. Oh my God, those are the most amazing peonies. Where did you get them? And she told me about a peony farmer up here, I think in Bethel, perhaps, but he sells his flowers commercially, I think. So, of course, I had to track him down. I found out who he was. I tracked him down, a couple of emails to the fat lady. And he told me, I sent him a photo, and he told me what the cultivar was. And that's how I came to this peony, and I found the peony online and bought the peony. And then, of course, it takes 3 years before it'll bloom. But it is like an extraordinary peony, and it not only in terms of color and the size of the bloom, but it unfurls very, very, very slowly. The last week and a half, 2 weeks, I was like, hurry up already. But it's very dense, and it must be like a double, triple, I don't know what you would call it. It's just a very dense peony.
It's a gorgeous color. It's like a scarlet. Describe this, because it's the size of a grapefruit.
Yeah, it's actually the size of the flower is almost like the size of what you would expect with a tree peony or an Ito peony. The Ito peony is like a cross or a hybrid between a herbaceous peony, which is what this one is, and a tree peony, which is a woody peony. Mm-hmm. That doesn't really die back like the herbaceous ones do. So this is a herbaceous one, but the tree peony and Ito peony flowers tend to be really big. And even though this is a herbaceous peony, the blooms are really big.
It's extraordinary in color.
Gorgeous.
I'd like to walk back here a little bit, because before, when we were just taking a sample of the tour, I noticed something in the corner that was extraordinary because of the scent. I think that you are very much into fragrance with your gardens, and this is particularly beautiful. Describe what this plant is.
Yes, fragrance is my number one. I just love fragrance. Who doesn't? But I really do select plants for fragrance whenever I possibly can. And this is a mock orange. The cultivar is Starbright, and I purchased it at Catskill Native Nursery in Kerhonkson, a wonderful native plant nursery that I love and buy a lot of plants from. And this is an exceptionally fragrant mock orange. I have another mock orange that you have to work pretty hard at, you know, getting the fragrance. But this one is very redolent. And so I'm going to try to take some softwood cutting and try to propagate this. I don't propagate that much. And for me, it's kind of a hit or miss experience because I'm not that experienced. But I'm going to try to duplicate this plant.
I admire your challenge that you're taking on, but I just noticed that a lovely butterfly was inside the leaves here. You're doing a great job at attracting pollinators.
Yeah, I think so. I have a lot of native plants. I don't exclusively buy native plants because I'm not that much of a purist. It's certainly an emphasis in my garden, and so I like to think that those plants are attracting our native pollinators. And that's one of the wonderful things about gardening, is you create this environment, this little ecosystem, and it's like if you build it, they will come. You know, all of a sudden the birds come and the butterflies and the bees and caterpillars and beetles and maybe some things that you don't want so much, but you take the good with the bad. And they provide a purpose too, you know. So, yes, it is all part of the whole pleasure and joy of gardening, is what, not just the plants, but, you know, the creatures that it attracts.
You're so resplendent in this garden. I guess you transcend the challenges that some creatures, critters bring to the garden.
Well, transcend. Let's see. I'm working on that. I've been working on that for 30 years. You know, gardening is, it's like a practice. And part of the practice is living with ambiguity, living with not having control over a lot of things, living with death, living with change. I like to think that I'm better at all of that, and that hopefully that transfers into my life outside the garden as well. I think the garden is an amazing teacher. It really shines a light on your vulnerability and who you are, and then begs you to, you know, to be more tolerant and to be more patient and to look at things in a different way. So that's one of the things that I really love about gardening. Gardening has challenges, but I think when you look at the scale and the joys and the pleasures and the excitement compared to that, there's no contest.
That's very well put. And what we're looking at here through this fence is Anthony's garden, I believe. It's a vegetable garden. Now, describe this, because I think it'll be on the tour. People will be able to look through this and see what is growing here.
Yes. Well, this is Anthony's domain, and he loves garlics. So you can see there's like six beds of garlic, and we like to have enough to take us through a whole year. And we don't get really fancy with what we plant. You know, we've got zucchini and Roman beans. We've got basil and parsley. We have cucumbers. I grow soybeans. I really love the soybeans. You know, what we do isn't terribly exotic, and we still shop at the farmer's market. We have lots of herbs, too. I mentioned parsley and basil, but, you know, we have oregano and tarragon and rosemary. It's enough for us. You know, we're only two people, and Anthony is the mastermind of the garden design, and he uses logs from the property and brings them in and uses them to border the beds and then lets them break down to build the soil.
Well, that's very thoughtful and sustainable in terms of the ecosystem in our environment. That's something to be admired, because what I love about this garden is that it's not glamorous. It's natural. It reminds me of like my grandfather's garden, where they would take objects from the yard, use what they had for the structures, for every aspect of it. And that's what Anthony's doing. I really admire that.
Yes, that's very true. He loves the idea of using the property, using what's on the property, and repurposing it for an ecological benefit. So, and everybody that comes into his garden loves it. It's asymmetrical. It's not like this perfect raised bed with, you know, boards going all around. It's very authentic, which I think is how I think of my ornamental gardens as well. It's very authentic. Being an amateur gardener, being self-taught, it's not, you know, you'll go to a public garden and you'll see lots of perfection. And I love those experiences. I love going to public gardens. That's not necessarily always what you're going to find here. You're going to see the result of someone who's learned a lot and is very dedicated and very excited and very passionate, but also someone who's living with her mistakes that she made 30 years ago, 25 years ago, and that's the way it goes.
You have a beautiful expression on your face as you're saying that, and I wanted to add that both you and Anthony seem very playful in your gardening.
I guess I am. I never thought of it that way, but every day I wake up 8 months out of the year, because I start in March. I mean, the minute the ground is thawed, I am out there. I'm so excited. I just can't wait to get out. And I think it is playing. It is like being 5 years old again. Things are always shifting. I mean, just today before you came, I had some new plants, and I'm looking at the area where they could go. And I said, no, this, maybe I'll move this here. Maybe I'll take this out. Maybe I'll shift this to where this other plant was. And it is like being in a sandbox in a way, like a little kid. You are playing, because that's what creating is. Creating is sort of clearing your mind and looking at the possibilities. And I'm doing that all the time, because there's a lot of musical chairs going on in this garden all the time.
There's also a lot of sculptural aspects of this garden. It's very colorful. It's organized, but not neurotically so. It really lends itself to a walking meditation.
I think I couldn't be that organized even if I tried. I kind of admire people that can do that. It's not in me, you know. Everything that I've done here has been not pre-thought out, not pen to paper. It's just, what would look good? And just, it's like intuitive, you know, would this, the stature of this plant, the structure of that plant, the color, the form, when it blooms, everything about it, you know, how does it relate to its neighbors? Those are all the things that are going on in my head. And it's not really scientific, but it is what horticulture is about. I mean, I think I'm doing it on a different level than the great garden designers, you know, of the world, that, you know, designers that have been considered the greats. But it's the same process. It's the same process. It's just, you know, looking at things and seeing things in a certain way and then just going for it.
Well, I think a lot of science is about observing. It sounds like what you're saying is you observe the plant in its natural form and experience, and you take that into consideration. You're absorbing all that observation. That's really something to be noted. And I'd like to walk over to this little patch over here, because as we were walking around, this is a great garden gate. It's very substantial, and I love the bottom. It's doubled up with poultry and quarter-inch
hardware cloth.
Yes,
that's
critters.
Because I try to keep out the groundhogs and the rabbits.
Yeah. Well, yeah, when we were walking over here over the lawn, I noticed this low creeping, it's very elegant. There's it features an old stump of a decayed maple tree, but it's a carpet, and you're going to describe this. This is lovely.
This is creeping thyme, and it's just a wonderful ground cover. And I have it in a couple of places. I have it here. I have it in the main garden. And then I use it for culinary purposes. Because it begs to be trimmed, because it, you know, it spreads. And so I shave it back, and I dig it up, and I, you know, and then I basically dry it for, you know, for kitchen purposes. But it really is a great ground cover. And really, one of the things that I have spent a lot of time focusing on in the last, you know, years is really trying to get a lot of ground cover in places where there hadn't been before. I mean, I've always been working on that, but it's more developed. Instead of looking at like a lot of mulch. You're looking at living mulch. You're looking at plants. And I let things grow up through the living mulch. So with the time in the main garden and right where we're standing, things are growing up from it. And so you're not looking at like a bunch of wood chips. Mm-hmm. And it's a really nice effect.
It's gorgeous. Color-wise and texture-wise, it's very natural. I really like your approach to things. Very, very natural and easy. Here's another garden gate. Mm. Who built these garden gates?
When the garden started to become pretty serious, I realized that we needed to keep out the critters. And so that's when the fence was built, this wood curvy fence and the hog wire. And it was the same contractor that built the fence. And it's very artistic. It's really, everybody loves our fence. It's beautiful. But of course, you know, there's a lot of plantings in front of it. So it's, you're not just looking at fence, but it peeks through and it's really lovely.
Now we're inside the main garden here. And what I took note of on arrival was that you have patches of grass that are small, but they highlight the garden, and it's accented by this lovely bluestone or slate.
The bluestone path was one of the main architectural features of the front of the house when we bought the house. Very old. You know it's old because of the way it's cut. There's bluestone steps and a bluestone wall, and that creates the two different tiers of our garden. And so that becomes the hardscape. And the grass paths, you know, initially I thought, oh, I'm going to get rid of all the grass. And then, of course, if you get rid of all the grass, you know, when you're developing a garden, then you're in a jungle. So you need to have some kind of way to see the garden. And so I decided to keep the grass as paths because it's soft on the feet and it is a nice contrast to the planting beds that I have. I wish I had kept my paths a little bigger. It's intimate, and so I think it's okay. You know, people don't seem to complain about it. But as a gardener, you're always kind of, you know, looking at things critically. But people seem to love the intimacy of the small, windy paths with the beds popping up out of it.
Before we close, is there anything you'd like to add?
I started taking notes and writing a memoir in about 2014 because I thought this is something that I have to write down. It's such a profound thing, gardening. I just wanted to put it down on paper, and I felt like it was cathartic. I really thought I was doing it for me, but as it took shape, it called out to me to be something that I could share. And so I've been working on that for many years as I've developed as a gardener. So we'll see what happens. I would love for it to be published and to share all that I know and all my experiences with other gardeners. And I think there are a lot of gardeners like me who, they're amateur gardeners. They're either new gardeners or they're weekend gardeners, or they're hungry for information and they like hearing other people's stories.
Sally Rowe's Barryville Garden will once again be part of the Garden Conservancy Open Days program for the 2025 season. The date is Saturday, June 28th, from 10 a.m. until 4 p.m. Tickets are now available online for Sally's Barryville Garden by visiting the website gardenconservancy.org. Look for Garden Directory Open Days Sally's Garden. The Garden Conservancy is a nonprofit organization devoted to preserving, sharing, and celebrating America's gardens. This year, over 300 participating gardens across 22 states will be open to the public. We hope that you enjoyed our show this week with production by Radio Catskill volunteers Keith Hubbard and myself, Rosie Starr. Special thanks goes to our guest, Sullivan County resident and gardener Sally Rowe, participant in the 2025 Garden Conservancy Tour. Thank you for listening local to Farm and Country and supporting Radio Catskill. We are Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR.
Hey there, I'm Jason Dole. We've been telling Radio Catskill listeners like you that public media is under threat. We've been telling you to go to protectmypublicmedia.org. Well, right now, we are facing our most immediate and serious threat yet. This week, the White